Welcome to the Hobby of a Lifestyle podcast, a show that looks at how our passions impact lives and drive career choices. I'm Andy Gray, a former national and world champion kickboxer. During my shows, I'll be talking with athletes, coaches, fans and more as I delve into their world to find out what inspired them on their journey. Welcome to Hobby of a Lifestyle. This week's guest is dubbed the Charity Adventurer. And before we get in, what better place to start with than our little indie band song, Believe. It's already broke the top 60 on the official iTunes chart. It's only 79 pence and all proceeds go towards helping Homeless Northeast, who support vulnerable and homeless people across the country. So please, for the sake of 79 pence, go and support our little indie band, Believe. Here's a little bit of the track now. Go on, support them. Let's get them into the top 10, if not number one. That is Believe by our little indie band raising money for a great cause. And talking of raising money for great causes, today I'm joined by the man dubbed the Charity Adventurer, Josh Stinton. He's completed some of the world's biggest challenges and his journey from the US to where he is now is quite extraordinary. I cannot wait to share his journey. So let's get into it and find out the whole story. Good afternoon, Josh. Welcome to Hobby of a Lifestyle. Thank you for joining me today.
Hello, Andy. Thank you very much for having me. I love the show. Like I said, going through and looking at all the other people that you've had the opportunity to speak with, I'm like, I've done a lot of good things in life in this conversation time.
Oh, I can't wait for this one. Especially with the upcoming challenge we kind of just briefly touched upon before we press record. Josh, do you just want to tell listeners, I suppose, what your job title is, what your passion?
Yeah, job title. It's evolved, right? Because I come from a background of business design. So right. I used to work with like some pretty big firms. Like I used to work in two of the big four consulting firms around business modeling and how to help people solve complex problems using models.
Okay.
And so what I did, I was in that world for a number of years and I kind of unpacked some of the models and I've applied them into other aspects of life in finding ways to impact programs that are raising help for children's causes around. That's what I'm very passionate about. So all roads lead to me trying to help as many kids as I can before I die. That's my purpose. Wow. So I've fooled around a lot, Andy, and I've actually kind of accidentally made a career out of it. And by way of documentaries now. So it's been really fun.
Oh yeah, I can't wait to get into it. So if we go back to the beginning as a child, where did you grow up and what were your hobbies growing up?
Yeah. Oh, so I grew up in Denver, Colorado, like outside of Denver. So I'm a Colorado boy originally, and I would spend my the summers on the farm. My family came from farming in South Dakota, north of the U.S. So we came from Norway originally, hence me living here now.
Yeah.
And so my family came from Norway, ended up in South Dakota area and farming. And so as a kid, I would go spend time with my grandparents on the farm. And I got some of my best life lessons in that environment. And I'd spend a lot of time with my grandfather. He said that he had this passion where he said, if we have the opportunity to help others, it's not an opportunity, it's a responsibility. And we used to take a lot of excess crops that we had on the farm or tools or whatever people needed in the broader community. We'd pack it into his truck. And just drive around. Yeah, and just drive around and knock on doors and see what people needed. And I learned from a young age, like I was like 6-7 years old at the time. And in my mind, I'm thinking, why are we giving this stuff away? Because if we could be selling it, I could get more toys.
Yeah. Right?
So I was like really driven. I'm like, we're missing a transaction here. I remember my grandfather was so strict. As I said, when I was a kid, I was so confused. Like, why are we giving this stuff away? Like, why are we giving crops and tools and stuff to other farms? Because if we're selling them, like, getting money, I'd get more toys as a kid, right? That was my thing. I remember as a kid, my grandfather, he was a really lovely man, Wesley, and he was always quite playful, but this is the first time I saw him very serious. And he said, this is your job. He said, when you have the ability to help other people, you help them. And it wasn't so much as, of course, this is way before the internet. So this wasn't a selfie. There was no likes. There's none of that stuff. And he wouldn't even really accept so much as a thank you. Certainly nothing in return.
Hey.
And I remember that when I was a young guy, and I just remember the impact that he would make. This was on a farm community basis. So we're not talking grand scale. But it was just so important for him to help. And that really carried with me, and my family really marches to that. I have many brothers, many younger brothers, and they're all quite similar. And so my thing is I don't have crops or tools, because if I had to grow a crop for a living, I'd be a hungry man. I've got time. And what I do is I find ways to dedicate my time to help as many charities, help as many kids as I can. So it's just been in my fabric since I was a young guy, and that's carried through with me for my life. And so now it's my purpose, and I'm very strict about it.
So it's absolutely phenomenal. But as a young child, having that ingrained in you, no pun intended, by the way, with a
grin. Well done.
But having that ethos ingrained in you from being young, can you remember your first time that you started raising money for charity or giving back to the community?
I remember there was a lot of different ways in which we would do it. It wasn't so much, I mean, you saying this, I haven't actually cast my mind back to this in a little while, but one of the first memories that comes back is like helping. When my father grew up, he moved to the city. So I lived in Denver, right, Colorado, for my upbringing for the most part. And we would, same thing, you know, at Christmas time, Dad would bake like 14, 15 pie, like pumpkin pies, and we'd pack these kits and like give them around to neighbors. And every year we were excited because that meant we were make one more pie to give to one more neighbor. And it was always just this feeling of giving. So that was also when I was quite young. But then as I got a bit older, I'm really passionate about playing drums.
Okay.
And I've been a drummer since I was about 4 years old. Wow. And so what I would do as a kid is I found these clinics that you could give drum lessons to other kids in need. There was a group called Save the Children was big in it. There was a number of different things. So even as a younger guy, I would go and give drum lessons to at homeless shelters. That was great. And then also at children's camps that were there for like children in rehab or children that were in a bit of a rough way. Wow. And so I just gained a lot of energy from that as a young guy. And then as time went on, I just started engaging in activities that would raise money. Of course, you know, there's different types of things you can do around community drives and donate here and all that. And then for me, I kind of fell on this magic kind of model, actually, because I suck at sports. Like, I'm awful, right? I'm horrible. And I'm not an athlete. Actually, when I was in high school, I got kicked off the football team for being a bad athlete. I can like coach athletes instead of a soccer player because I was no good. And so I never had this kind of ingrained, I'm going to run a half marathon to raise money as a normal model. And then one thing happened. This was about 6 years ago now. I was in a conversation with a good friend of mine from Sweden in Australia, because I lived in Australia for about 13 years, just over 13 years. And I was in a conversation with a buddy of mine over pizza and a couple of beers. And he was telling me about this massive ski race in Sweden, the biggest cross-country ski race in the world, called Vasaloppet. It's 90 kilometers long. Wow. And it's kind of the crown jewel of ski races for skiing careers. So my ego got into it, and as I said, there was a couple of beers in that dinner.
And that's where the best ideas are formulated over a couple of beers.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. You just have to back up the next day.
When 1,000,000%, yeah.
But so he told me about this race, and I said, I want to do it. And he's like, well, you don't know how to ski. Now, so as I said, I'm from Colorado originally. I've never skied.
Oh, really?
You know, I live. I lived a bit south of the state, but it's just, it was not a thing for in my world anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I said I wanted to do it. So I kind of had this thing in the back of my mind. And shortly after, I was introduced to a guy, his name's James Thomas. James and his wife, Christy, wanted to start, they're in the process of starting a small charity that was going to help children living with grief. So if their mom or dad or sibling has passed away, there's a camp where these kids get to go to learn that they're not alone.
Wow.
And so it was just in its early stages. And then I kind of, in my mind, I kind of put the two together and I thought, well, what if I take on the hardest ski race in the world and raise some money for you guys that way?
Wow.
And I remember my James, my very Aussie buddy, he's like, all right, mate. He's like, well, we'll give you a t-shirt. Don't know how to support, never had an ambassador. I'm like, yeah, cool. So then what I did is I Googled how to train for cross-country skiing on land.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, as you do. And I, because I lived in Sydney, you know. I mean,
There's no snow.
The brochures don't lie. It's not an alpine paradise.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I found I heard about these roller skis that are quite common in Europe, you know? Not common in Australia.
No.
So there's a group called Roller Ski Australia in Perth. There's two Norwegian women that were importing roller skis and trying to get the sport going in Australia. And it was taken off over in the West Coast.
Wow.
And so they sponsored me. They sent me a pair of roller skis to train. Mate, I looked like a young Bambi. It was awful.
I can kind of relate. I remember going over to New York a few years ago with my wife, and during the January period, they had something called Winter Fest or Winter Jam, where they basically encouraged locals to come out in the winter. So it was snowing in Central Park, and they had all these stalls set up, and you could try cross-country skiing. So we I had a little try cross-country skiing with my wife, and I think I fell over once or twice.
Then you're doing good.
I was only on for 2 minutes.
Perfect. So yeah, man. So the story picked on. So I was working full time at a firm at the time. I was at KPMG in Australia. I was working in the innovation team there.
Right.
Team. But I was getting up really early in the morning to get on these roller skis, and man, my motivation was like dwindling. Yeah. But the more I actually volunteered to be a counselor at one of these grief camps that my friends had just started. So I got to connect with the kids. I started to hear their story, and then my motivation just skyrocketed. Yeah. And so one thing led to another. I was out roller skiing wearing this charity shirt as I was every day. And a woman stopped me one day, and she asked, you know, what I was up to. And I told her, and she told me that she was the editor of a newspaper. And if I wanted an interview, I was like, wow. Brilliant. You know, yeah. I'd never been in the media before. And I thought, you know, at least my mom would be proud. So off I go on this interview, and the interview went well. It was a digital paper, an online newspaper.
Right.
And that interview made its way back to the Today Show producers, so our biggest TV show in Australia. I got a call from them the next day, and they said, look, we've seen this. Would you like to come on and tell your story? And I'm like, yeah. It's like two questions. One, is it live? Like, yeah. All right. Okay. Like, you know, about everything in your anatomy tenses up. I was like,
yeah.
And two, I said, how about how many people are going to watch it? And I said, on a Thursday morning, about 2.1 million catchment
viewers.
I was like, okay, brilliant. I said, as long as I can talk about the charity.
Yeah.
And then I've since come to learn that you, on like morning TV, you'll get like 2 to 3 minutes, you know, for like the morning feel good TV shows. They gave me about 7.5 minutes, and they let me play a video about the charity. And because of that interview, over 200 families signed up for the charity that had children living with grief.
Amazing, isn't it? And that's a real victory, isn't it? There.
Massive. So then I realized, I was like, okay, this is a win. And that interview also changed my life in a pretty big way, because that interview started getting shared around through different communities, and it's made its way back to the Norwegian Olympic community. I got an email from the Norwegian Olympic ski team director offering to sponsor me for the ski race.
Wow, that is unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I wrote back. I was like, for the removal of any doubt, you're the world champions.
Yeah.
I don't know how to ski. Like, I've never done it. Like, no, we loved it. And they sent a video back from a guy named Anders Hockland, who's the world champion.
Yeah,
welcoming me as an honorary team member for the year. And I'm like, oh my goodness.
Qualified for Sochi Olympics.
Chewing. So I was like, all right, brilliant. But they, like, fast forward 7 odd months. And here I was in Sweden, the start of the race. It was minus 17 degrees, 7 o'clock in the morning. And I met the Olympic team and because they gave me the skis. Because I'd never skied until the morning of the race.
Oh, wow.
Ever. And so they gave me my skis and they said, we've waxed them for the right conditions. I was like, oh, you've got to wax them. They're like, oh. It was brilliant. So there I was, the beginning of the ski race, and I'd never skied. The gun goes off, the starting gun goes off, and I push, right? Just push. First time I'd ever been on skis. And I just nail the guy in front of me because I don't know how fast I'm going to go. So I just rack this guy up. And so to give it an idea of the race, there's 16,000 people that do the race every year. And I hit this guy, and we almost fall over. And he's an older guy, and he turns around and he says something in Swedish. And to which I said, I'm sorry, mate, I've never skied. So, right, Norwegian Olympic suit that I'm wearing. And it's the spark of the hardest skier in the world. And he looks at me and he's like, today's going to be the hardest day of your life. I was like, I know. I just have to go that way. He's like, for a long time. Like, yeah. But I did it, right? So fast forward. You have to complete the race in 13 hours.
13. Right, okay. And it's downhill.
Yeah, it's a lot of downhill and a lot of uphill and a lot of fast.
Yeah, it sounds.
So people on average kind of finish it at about 7-8 hours.
Okay.
The quick people, the women and men that do that super fast, they're like under 4.
Wow, that's crazy.
It took me 11 hours, 8 minutes, and 58 seconds.
Doesn't matter as long as you finish.
Totally. And so I crossed the line, and it was great because I didn't realize, but I actually set a world record because I'm the first person in the race's 100-year history to complete it without ever having skied.
I love that. That is brilliant. That is amazing.
Many other people competing for that title, so it's easy to get a record in that state. But it was great. So then, and of course, because of that, there were loads more interviews. There's more TV, there's more newspapers and all that. And then as a net, like over 500 families in Australia signed up for the grief counseling camp. And then the Australian government got involved offering grants. To help them expand their services. They were all in a really good way, but it was great.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. Were your friends kind of, on one hand, super grateful because you had now brought their project to life and helped them realize a dream of helping children who were in grief? But at the other hand, were they going, Josh, this has escalated far too fast. We don't have enough counselors to deal with all of this. How do we upskill so quick?
I could say if they did, and they probably did have those feelings, they were quite kindly quiet about it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I'm a small part of their success story, that's for sure. But it was an honor to be a part of it. But that's the thing. So then I realized I've got a model on my hands. So that is, if I keep taking on some of the hardest, most ridiculous things in the world that I have no experience in, as a way to help children's causes, then I've got an interesting model. Like, that's where the magic happens. So I just kept going. So now I've got 5 challenges under my belt. I set 3 world records, and now I'm currently designing my 6th, which we talked about briefly.
Let's talk about the second one then. In fact, actually, let me go back a little bit further if that's okay, because I would love hearing about these challenges. They're amazing. But you've talked extensively about travel and not living in Denver, you know, and where you grew up as well. What took you to Australia for 13 years? Was it just business? Was it something that you wanted? Were you just like every other kid who finishes university and goes, I'm going backpacking for a year?
Yeah, actually, you know what it was? I was 6 years old. I was six. And where I grew up, Denver is just mountains, mountain and no ocean to be seen. So I grew up fantasizing about mountains, or I'm sorry, about the ocean and about waves. And I saw, this is actually, I've never said this on a podcast interview. This is great.
Oh, it's an exclusive.
Yeah, exclusive. I saw a cartoon. There's like a cartoon movie called Dot and the Whale.
Right.
And it was a young girl. She happened to be Australian and she saved a beached whale's life. Right. And I was 6 years old and I fell in love with this girl. I was like, oh my God, this girl is the best. Australia is the future.
That's where I'm coming.
So I talked about it all the time. And I remember my dad even saying, like, playfully, but he was like, you know, I'll take you to the Outback Steakhouse because that's probably as close as you're going to get. And yes, I just said in, but I think that kind of, I haven't thought about it in that way, but I think that was kind of a foreshadowing of what was to come, because I really, really hook in to a big crazy idea that takes a lot to bring to life.
Yeah,
like that's my special spot, you know, in terms of endurance. Sprinting, burst efforts, I do have passion. Like I'm the next challenge is about running, like interval training. Things are like burst efforts. I'm not going to say I'm not good at it, but my mentality is much more suited to just long drawn out. Have this mental resilience and just fight for a long time. That's my spot.
No, so, yeah. Sounds like it. So you've done your first ski race, your first challenge. And I can imagine, as you said, you've been inundated with media and it's been passed around circles. What was the next challenge? Because, you know, that's a huge mammoth challenge to take on first. And I'm sure people are straight away, what's your next challenge? Yes, what's your next challenge? And it doesn't always happen like that. I'm sure it's a process. You have to go back, reflect, and maybe wait to be inspired for the next challenge.
It's interesting because I was not planning to continue on. Like, it wasn't I'm going to take on challenges.
Yeah.
It was, I'm going to do this thing. And even before I had done the race, I had people asking like, oh, what's going to be the next thing? It's like, you know, in my community, and I didn't have that big of a community around me at the time, but, you know, friends and, you know, colleagues and whatnot were like, you know, what's going to be the next thing? It's like, oh, I don't know. And I was in a conversation with a friend of mine. So I used to do production work, volunteer for TED, like TEDx Sydney.
Yeah, yeah.
And I met a lot of brilliant people in that environment. And this guy, his name's Tango, really lovely guy, came out from New York to visit Australia. And he and I were talking about the challenge and all this. And he said, you know, I've been hearing about this sport coming out of Canada called downhill mountain unicycling. I was like,
wow,
put your beer down. You've had too much.
Like, yeah, this
is really, you know, and he just kind of planted the seed. And then I was at a dinner party about 2 months after that. So this is still before I'd done the ski race. I was at this dinner party and someone asked me, well, are you thinking of something else after? And I said, well, no, but I have heard about this sport called mountain unicycling. On the other side of the table, this guy, he's from the UK, and his eyes just got massive. And he's like, how did you hear about Muni? I'm like, Muni? I felt like I stepped into a cult. Like, I don't know. And he said, 1 second. It was his house. He goes into a room in the house and comes out with a mountain unicycle.
Really?
And he's changed shirts. He's got a shirt that says NBUC for Northern Beaches Unicycle Club.
Like, that's what? Amazing.
He's like, yeah. So he explained. His name's Charles Allen. He's become a very good friend. But he said that he's the president of the unicycle club and he will train me. And he knows about the race. By the time I finished the ski race, it was 4 months after. That was the world champion of mountain unicycling coming up in San Sebastian, Spain.
Right.
And I could go up with them and represent Australia in the biggest mountain unicycle race. So I took it on. I did it.
In four months.
Yeah. It took me about 5 odd months to learn how to unicycycle.
Right.
And then I took it. Yes. It was 14 kilometers downhill off-road, no roads. Wow. It was like rocks and stumps and all sorts. But I got there in the end. It took me an hour and 44 minutes to complete it. I didn't come last out of 350 people. I was like,
wow.
Fifth from last?
Yeah. I just completing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And was that one for a charity again that time, Josh?
That was for charity as well. So they're always a different charity.
Yeah, yeah.
Different cause, because there's a lot of media that happens around every one of them now, which is great. And I like to use them as a platform to raise it, like shed light on a new
cause. Of course.
And in particular, children involved in that. So like I've learned that it's nice to say I'm supporting this charity because they are doing this for this cause, Eric.
Yeah, yeah.
When you can really hone in and say, this girl's name is Ritaj and this is her story.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it humanizes the process. So
yeah, that's of course.
So,
yeah. So what charity was that one for?
That one was actually called, it was a charity called Milk Crate Theater. And that was a charity that was helping families with children learning how to overcome homelessness and when there's drug addiction in the family.
Yeah.
And they use play and theater as a way to help people therapeutically come out of their situation. That was also Sydney-based. So that was great to work.
Oh, yeah, I bet it was. And then as the media frenzy starts to build now, is it just a case of, I'm kind of invested in this challenge culture now and I want to keep progressing with it? Or was after the unicycle where you just thought, I'm still not 100% sure whether or not I want to invest my time in this?
Oh, I was in. I gotta be honest. Once I crossed the finish line for the ski race, but once I was on the start line, I knew I woke up a monster in me. It was so. And don't get me wrong. I mean, there's definitely ego associated. This stuff is fun to do, you know, and it's great being that person to go do that thing. And it's, I really appreciate being recognized for the stuff that I've done. But like expanding on that and seeing how, it satiates personal needs that I have. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I think there's a culture of when you're doing things for good, it's got to be this purely altruistic, you know, selfless, like the things they give to you are fantastic. And these challenges and the community and the feedback and the people I've been able to meet, like Olympians and kids with big stories and sponsors and all that stuff. Man, it's incredible. And that started really quickly on in the ski race. And so now it's just hooked. I'm happy to share an update that I also haven't shared yet because it's just confirmed here recently about a career shift of mine that's actually moving forward because of these challenges. It's just become a life by design rather.
Yeah, it's amazing. So you've now heavily invested. You've decided this is the career route you want to take. You want to keep continuing to help charities and work with children for various causes. What was challenge three? Where did the inspiration come from it?
So challenge three came from, and one point before we go on, I want to make a note of as well as 100% of every cent that gets donated goes directly to the cause. So I've never earned a dollar out of anything. I never will. I have been advised that, you know, set up a foundation and I could take a percentage of earnings.
Of course.
Like I just very happily transparent around that, but you know, every dollar that gets donated goes directly to the cause. And from that, I've got content. So I get a story because people often ask, well, how do you earn a living? And up until now, it's been a lot of the insights and again, the business design modeling I bring into it as well. I earn a living as a presenter and keynote speaker and consultant helping.
Yeah, I'd imagine that. In my head, it was endorsements and, you know, being sponsored for you rather than the actual charity. But the donations go to the charity, then you're endorsed and you do your talks and whatever else comes with that side of it as well.
I'd like to see that early on in the piece because it does come up.
I can imagine.
But so challenge number three, that was a good friend of mine, Andreas, that lives up in the Arctic, in Tromsø, in Norway, far north of Norway. This is before I lived here.
Right.
He reached out and told me about this mountain bike race that's the hardest mountain bike race in the world. It's 700 kilometers across the Arctic. And
wow.
It was by far still the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Really?
So I signed up for it and trained. I didn't train as hard for it as I should have, and that was a learning because I got this kind of superhuman kind of complex where it's like, yeah,
I can just see, you know, I've just done 14 kilometers on a unicycle down a mountain. 700 kilometers is easy on two wheels.
I've ridden a bike before. Go in that direction. Oh man. So I definitely was training, but I learned early on that it's important to become friends with fear, right? Yeah. Because certainly there was things around the challenge that I was afraid of, but I wouldn't allow myself to look at it. So I was like, nah, I've got this. I've ridden a bike.
Yeah.
And that was a lesson because if I would have looked into it, I would have learned that first off, I had to climb 3,600 meters of glacier with the bike tied to my back to get parts of the trail. And like, and of course, you're up in the Arctic, the sun never set. It was in July.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know if it was noon or 4 a.m. or whatever. Wow. And also, I would have learned about Arctic mosquitoes. Oh, man. If I had the persistence of one Arctic mosquito, I could retire tomorrow. These things are the most diligent, hardworking little demons. And they're like little birds. They're not mosquitoes. And there's just thousands of that. You're covered the whole time.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, you're just done for. And yeah, of course, you got your shell jacket and all your stuff on. It doesn't matter. They're in. They're going to find their way in. So I would have been aware of that. But that was a big lesson. And that one was interesting because it was a 700-kilometer mountain bike race, and we were a team of three.
Right.
So there was Charles, the guy that was the president of the Unicycle Club. Tommy of errors, mate. He's a very fit guy. And also my friend Tommy from Townsville, Australia. Never seen snow in his life. So right. He was, this is amazing. The first patch of snow we crossed, he wanted to stop and take photos. It's like, race.
Snow angels.
Yeah, basically. I got a video of it. He was doing them. Come on. And those guys were super, they were very serious and incredible, and very fit and fitter than me. I was the weak link in that group. And they were incredible. But we made it to the 200-kilometer checkpoint, and we found out we were over time by like an hour and 10, so got disqualified.
Oh, really?
We weren't able to complete the whole race. We stopped at 200. It was after almost 30 hours of nonstop cycling. We started at 6 o'clock at night, so we've been up for well over almost 2 odd days. And we're delirious, we're hallucinating. I saw, I get this feeling in me every time I think about it. We're on the top of this mountain pass in the middle of nowhere. My GPS broke. It was just their GPS is working.
And I just paused 2 seconds because I think this is the consultant. Sorry for interrupting you, Josh. I have just got off the phone call with the consultant. just to confirm, hip replacement is needed. Is needed.
Yes. Yes. And congrats. When I was younger, my dad said, the way we don't want to be putting our bodies away when we're done in good condition. You use your body like a rental car with full insurance.
Well, it's definitely done that. There's already parts coming out. They'll be able to recycle it when I go. Never mind. Anyway, where were we? Where did I really interrupt you?
Yeah, no, not really in the least. We were chatting at the end of the mountain bike race. Just hit the 200K.
That's part. Right, yeah.
And found out that that was tricky, right? Because that was fantastic in so many ways, but tricky at the time. Because I've never not completed something and then being told that you made it 200K, you can't go off and do the hit the finish line. And as I was saying before, like it was really insanely difficult. We were hallucinating. It was by far one of the most difficult things ever. And when we got to that checkpoint and found that out, it was really hard. I mean, I got to be honest, I was stressed. I was crying, the next day I was so down because I didn't complete a challenge. And I thought, do I have to do this again next year? But then it gave me a chance to zoom out because for that challenge, I was supporting a children's charity based in Norway that was helping children in Lebanon that are new refugees coming over from Syria.
Right.
So it was helping Lebanese and Syrian families learn to live together and primarily focusing on the kids in the family unit in these refugee camps. And for that charity, I was invited by the Minister of Social Affairs of Lebanon and got to go into these refugee camps and meet some families. And I met a little girl, a 6-year-old little girl. Her name is Ritaj, and she had cancer in her face. Right. In her throat. And the camp said, the camp leader, the Shavish, the Lebanese camp leader said that unfortunately that they weren't going to be able to help her out, because with the money, it's going to take about $20,000 for her surgery.
Right.
And $20,000 obviously go for other tents and help
Of course.
And I was heartbroken because I, and I just got it in me. I got quite arrogant about it. When we got back into the van, you know, you don't cry in front of people in need, obviously.
Yeah, but yeah, I was really bottling it up.
I got back into the van when we were leaving the camp, and it hit me. I said, you know, I don't care what I have to do, but I've met her now.
And
I go back to Australia, where I was living in Sydney at the time. If I go back to Australia and have to get a personal loan for 20 grand, that's going to happen. Like, this is going to happen. So I reached out. Thankfully, I was invited back on. I went on, what was it? It was ABC News on Saturday morning. And then I went on for the Today, the morning show, the competitor of the Today show. I went on both of those shows in the morning. And I was able to talk about Retouch in particular. Because they were like, oh, and by then I got the title. It was the Australian media that gave it to me. They welcomed me back on the show as the charity adventure. The charity adventure thing kept coming up. And, oh, that's all right. It kind of succinctly says what I do.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they said, oh, the charity adventure is back. And it kind of went on the story about the upcoming mountain bike race. And I was able to talk about Retouch and the money that we needed for her in particular.
Yeah, yeah.
And from those, there's a number of different organizations and one big Norwegian organization in particular that did chip in the money, and we got her the money and actually got her for surgery and saved her little life. And I actually have, that's her name on my arms, Retouch in Arabic, which constantly reminds me of the power of what these challenges can do. And so here I was, fast forward at the end of that race, didn't complete it. And I was pretty hammered that I didn't finish the race, but we saved a life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, that's the North Star, you know, all of these means to the end. And I was okay. It dissolved my ego around it, where I was like, no, I'm not going to take this race on next year. I'm going to do something different. This one was, and it was a learning experience.
Yeah,
so that was a big one for the third challenge.
Yeah, it's massive. And it, as you see, it puts things into perspective when a little 6-year-old could potentially lose her life, or you just didn't finish a 700 kilometer race. When you put it like that, though, perspective, it really doesn't matter, does it? You still did 200 kilometers more than most people would try.
Yeah, totally, man. And
save the little girl's life. We'll forever be grateful for what you've done for her.
Totally. And on that, you know, and also we went on to raise a lot more money than that as well.
Yeah.
A lot of families in the camp. So, yeah, if my focus was then frustration because the race didn't finish, then my priorities are off.
Yeah, of course.
A real cold light of day experience to be able to see that. And it was really nice to know that, that's that job done.
Definitely.
So that was good. So that was challenge number three.
Yeah, that's it sounds horrific. Challenge 700 kilometers in the Arctic, to be honest.
You know, it's like, even if there's a 200K race that comes up in the Arctic again, I'm going to quickly look the other direction.
Definitely. So what was challenge four then, and what was the charity?
Yeah, so four. So this is where there's a fork in the road where every challenge up until now had been an organized race.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something that exists, and fair play to them. I mean, these, even being getting to know the race organizers as I have, I mean, they have a massive job logistically and all that, and they do all the heavy lifting for that. You just, and I'm saying as an audio recording, I'm doing air quotes, just the track for the race.
Yeah.
But I got into this space of inventing things. I just started to kind of get playful. And again, just to circle back on that, full respect to the people that do take these races on, the organizing them, but I kind of like the idea of just coming up with something that's never been done.
Yeah.
And then I was in a conversation. There was an organization that reached out to me, and how this kind of spurred on. It was a group called Apricot Children, and they're a very small children's charity in Japan that wanted to help a bunch of kids in the recurring need that they have because of all the natural disasters that happen in Japan.
Yeah, yeah.
Natural disaster happens, earthquake, tsunami, you name it. I didn't realize there's over 150 earthquakes that hit Japan every year without fail. And these are constantly ripping families apart because dad usually stays behind and stays in the factory. And if radiation's in the area, then family has to move. And that's a common thing that families
are seeing.
And there's trauma for kids all over the place. And they're a beautiful and resilient culture, but what this charity was doing was working with the nurses, teachers, and counselors to help the family system. But of course, they need money. They need funds to be able to help these processes. So they reached out, told me about the charity. And then they playfully, because I saw one of the TV interviews that I was on, so they emailed me. They found me on LinkedIn. and they playfully challenged me to a race. They said, we would like to challenge you to a bike race. You can pick whatever bike you want, and that's fine. But we want you to race an Olympic hand cyclist that will cross the country. So you and an able body, an Olympian, it's only use of the upper body.
Yeah, yeah.
Go across. And I thought, wow. I mean, first off, I was honored that they reached out anyway. And then I got back and I said, I do have to explain myself a bit. I love what you're doing, but I'm not really a competitive person, to be honest. I want to beat that person over the line.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit different. And they came back and said, oh, good, because we didn't actually have a hand cyclist that was willing to cross the country. Really? They're like, yeah, the hand cyclist we know would be happy to go a certain distance. And I said, tell me more about this hand cycle. And they're like, well, and I kind of Googled it.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that's cool. I said, well, why don't I just cross the entire country on a hand cycle then? They're like, would you? I'm like, sure.
Yeah.
So on we go. No one's ever crossed the entire length of Japan on a hand cycle. So I did it. It took me about 2 years to organize that challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
And went down and I had a support team with me, as friends that came along and helped out along that journey. So I had an RV to sleep in at night.
Yeah, yeah.
It took me, I started at the very, very southern tip of Japan in Cape Sada, and I hand cycled all the way across all three islands up to the North Cape, up in Cape Soya. And that took me 22 days of nonstop hand cycling, about 9 to 10 hours every single day.
That's not a bad amount of time though to cover a full country. 22 days, I think that's really fast. I was expecting you to go, oh, yeah, it took us a couple of months, and it's like 22 days. Wow, just over 3 weeks. It's amazing.
Yeah, I was thrilled by it. And I mean, it was, and the stuff that I got to see, you know, it was fairly dangerous in the nature of it, because I stayed to the coastline. So there was an incredible guy named Egon, a New Zealander that lives there, a cyclist, a very keen cyclist, that I found on a Japan cycle group on Facebook.
Right.
And I just posted, I said, can anyone help me design a bike route across Japan? And he's like, well, we haven't crossed the country yet, but I can piece together a bunch of maps for you.
Yeah, yeah.
He goes, I'll try to keep it as low elevation for you as possible.
Yeah, of course. Otherwise
Japan can be like, you know,
yeah,
up and down. So low elevation meant hugging the coastline, meant on the highway, meant semi-trucks going by at 70 km regularly, and I was on a hand cycle, so I had the vantage.
Yeah, I was going to say, so low.
Yeah, so my face was regularly just at hubcap level with the trucks going by. Man, it was incredible.
I mean, how big were your arms by the end of that challenge?
Massive. It was great.
I'm just going this way.
Yeah. Sadly, that went away quick, but it was a little bit.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so did that. So we raised quite a bit of money for the charity help there on the ground. And then that planted a seed in me of, wow, all right, this is my trajectory now.
Yeah, yeah.
Never been done. I love the work of logistics, the getting people involved, and a lot of times, like there is right now with this next challenge, a lot of things is coming right down to the wire for regulation.
Yeah,
as you know, you told me about your
adventure. Yeah, we were just talking about this, weren't we, prior? And it's great to highlight. People only see the fact that you're doing these amazing challenges. They don't realize how much effort goes into organizing. I mean, you just said it was a 2-year plan to cycle across a country in 22 for 22 days.
Yeah.
It's crazy how and the amount of people you have to speak to, the hoops you have to jump through, the risk assessments for the risk assessments, because it's absolutely crazy. And have you got everyone in place, support teams? Oh, it's an absolute minefield, isn't it? And you know,
massive minefield. And it's in, especially when you're, as you well know, like when you're inventing something, it seems like every question that you answer breeds 3 more questions.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh wow. And it's just, I mean, I've got notes. I mean, after this, I've got calls with the project manager for the next one, and loads up. But I love it. Like that is like once you commit to it, you're in. And it reminded me I had an interview in Australia a number of years ago. It was a journalist. She's 19, and she was in university, and she asked me it was for a school paper.
Right.
She asked a uni paper. She asked it for an interview, and she asked a brilliant question. And she was talking about the ski race, because I'd only done the ski race at the time. And she said, when did the race start? And I said, it was 7 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
On, you know, and she's like, no. When did it start? I went, oh.
Yeah, it's right, isn't it?
Really interesting. I said, actually, yeah, that started about 11 months prior when I got my confirmation letter to go on and do the race. So
yeah.
So the race, you know, our goals start when we commit. It's not, oh, okay, I'm going to do that thing in a year's time. So that's when I know. Like, yeah. It's your journey begun now.
And how many people have told you on, I mean, I'm sure it happens with every single challenge that you do, it can't be done.
All the time.
All constantly. The
time. Yeah. Yeah. And I love it, you know, because yeah. I want to say it comes for the most part. I mean, sure, there's other comments that you don't read, but for the most part, they come from a position of care, you know?
Yeah. And that's, oh yeah, definitely.
And that's great. But when you hear that, it's first off, I always go in from a position of respect for each sport. So I don't have it in me like, yeah, I'm just going to show up and do the hardest thing in your sport. It's going to be fine. No, like, yes. You're constantly learning and you're there's a lot of grace involved and humility, true humility to be able to be that person that is a guest in a sports environment to take something on. But as long as you're coming from a position of humility and respect and saying, thank you for that insight. It's useful because it does help me position how serious this is, but I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I'm going to move on. Like, I'm going to go do the thing.
Yeah.
And so you do get that quite often, but it's great. You use it all.
Yeah. I get that. So you've done four challenges. Then you've got the fifth challenge, which will bring us up to the new one that's coming up soon. Yeah. So let's talk about the fifth challenge.
So the fifth one, as I said, I'm a presenter for a living. And this was back in 2000. This one came about fast. Oh, gosh. I gave a talk in Mexico. There was an adventure group in Mexico that had me out in Cabo San Lucas to give a presentation at an event they had.
It must have been horrible.
Oh, yeah.
Having to travel in Mexico must be horrible.
Yeah, that was very difficult. Yeah, leaving Scandinavia in the winter time to go to sunny Mexico. That was okay. Oh, can we just be done with Corona, please? But yeah, says me for traveling. Many people have. But I'm there in Mexico and I give a presentation about the things that I learned. And again, it's when I do give a talk, it's about a lot of the insights and what people can use and gain from my experience into their own journeys. And I'm giving this talk and these two guys came up afterwards out of the audience and they said they were going to charter a sailboat to cross the Atlantic. They were going to do this Mexican yacht racing team, basically.
Right.
And they said, would you like to join us? And I said, yeah, yes. When? It'll be next November. And that was like 4 months away. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. And so I told him, I said, guys, I've never sailed. So I'll be dead weight on the thing. But I said, you know, one thing I've always wanted to do, and I thought about this before, was take like a normal bike, like gym trainer bike. Onto a, like a cargo ship to bicycle across the ocean. So I'd have to cycle as many kilometers or as many miles as the boat has sailed during the day. So I thought that's something, because you should see my mind map. It's just ridiculous. It's a comedy, you know, but that's one thing that was on there. So that's one thing I'd like to do. And they said, well, why don't we get a bike onto the boat and we'll figure that out. So, okay. And then they connected me with the captain. He was less excited about it initially. He's a dead British captain. He's from Lymington and he's become a very good friend. He's actually the project manager for the next challenge now.
Right. Okay.
And he's a driver, you know, he gets projects done. He said, all right, well, first off, he didn't love it because I was going to be just fat on the boat, you know, taking up space, eating too much food, not helping on the sailing watch, useless, basically. And then he said, you know, if you can't just strap a bike down onto a sailboat anyway, because at any given time, you're going to be at like 40 odd degrees. Your knees out. And I said, well, if we were to do it, like if it could be done, what would that maybe look like? And he's like, well, I see what you're doing, but what you have to do, what you have to do is make a gimbal, like a bicycle gimbal, like a hammock. So no matter what the boat does underneath you, the bike stays.
Yeah.
And turns out he's a keen engineer and he's got keen engineering friends. So off they went to work and they built the world's first ocean going bicycle gimbal.
Wow.
And got it on I was looking at, it was better to look at recumbent bikes rather than diamond style sitting upright.
Yeah, of course.
So, and this is funny because I was in London at the time, also for a talk, and I was in London, and I'm bad at eBay. I'm actually no good at it. And I learned this because I was on eBay and I was looking at this guy who was selling a recumbent bicycle down at Walton on Thames, like quite a ways away from London. And I saw this hands or this recumbent bike, and I clicked buy, thinking it was going to take me to the buying options. And I just get an email: congratulations, you just spent £1,000 on a recumbent bike. So that day, I had to organize. I rented a Hertz van, drove down to Walton on Thames, picked up this recumbent bike from this guy that lives on a boat. So he, so I pick up this bike. Sent photos to the engineers. I'm like, will this do? They're like, well, it'll have to, jerk.
You just yeah, you bought it.
So they made it work, and off we went. And so that one took, we were at sea for 15 days. It was only 15 days.
But I thought it was going to be longer, but it's still a good amount of time.
Especially never having sailed, that was interesting. But yeah, so that was started cycling in Gran Canaria and ended up in St. Lucia in the Caribbean. Wow. I cycled, it was just over 3,400 miles.
Wow.
So I set a world record. I'm the first person in the world to bicycle across an ocean.
That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And what was that charity for?
So that was a charity called Los Cabos Children that I also met when I was in Mexico. So it was a charity over there helping kids with. They were helping kids with rehabilitation, cancer treatment, many, many sectors of care.
Yeah, yeah.
So
amazing. Amazing.
That was great. That was really cool. A lot of the kids were sending me drawings of what it's going to be like on the boat. And, and one young boy, his name is Danny, he was in an automobile accident and he became a quadriplegic.
Right.
So he lost the use of his arms and his legs. And so what he's done, he was a really keen drawer prior to. So what he did is he taught himself to draw using pens and pencils and his mouth.
Wow.
And he drew me, and I've got it up on my wall at home. He drew me a beautiful picture of a lion. He said it was going to take a lion's courage, but I had it. And,
oh, wow.
And he drew it with his mouth. And it's like far out. The care and community around these things. So completed that. And I cooked up the idea for what we're working on next.
Let's do that. Let's talk about it because this is amazing.
So, come September of this year, my goal is to be the first person in history to run through the sky.
Wow!
And I got that idea while I was out on sea because there's no birds, right? And because there's nothing for birds to land on.
Yeah,
so that got me thinking, oh, these skies are really empty. And I was delirious. I'm on top of this sailboat going across the ocean for so long, cycling again about 10 to 12 hours a day.
Wow.
And then I was thinking, how silly would it be if you could find a way to power an airship by running?
As you do.
While I was out there at sea, of course, I had no internet, so I couldn't Google if this has been done before.
And yeah.
I got to the Caribbean. When we docked in St. Lucia, I quickly hopped onto the Wi-Fi at the port there and found no one's done this before. Closely, there's a guy in France that has powered a blimp by bicycle.
Yeah,
so he has a bicycle up in the air, which is awesome, but no one's ever ran. So I linked back up with Matt, the captain of the ship, and he jumped right onto us. So that kind of worked out. But how that came about, so when I flew back to Norway, I just called, I Googled the Civil Aviation Authority of Norway.
Right.
I just phoned him. And this woman, this poor woman, I think she answers the phone. And I said, hi, my name is Josh, and I'm an adventurer, and I want to be the first person in the world to run through the sky. So I need to find out about a permit to run in an airship. This woman, it's like what?
Yeah, I can imagine it's like you got the right number, or are you looking for help?
Yeah. I'm not just gonna hang up on me. So she said, I'll tell you what, I'm gonna transfer you. So she transfers me to this guy, Arild. He's the head of Norwegian airspace.
Right.
And so I'm on the phone with him. I told him the same thing. He loved it. He's like, this is in very Norwegian. He's like, I've been running this department for 20 years. I have never had a call like this. And I'm like,
yeah. I can imagine. No wonder he loved it.
I think you're right. And he said, well, he asked me, he's like, are you an engineer? I said, no. He goes, well, you can't build this yourself then. I said, no. He said, you need a team. He goes, I recommend contacting NTNU. It's a Norwegian Technical University here in the middle of the country. So I, through a dear friend of mine, Froda, I contacted the head of of technical engineering at NTNU. He loved it, asked to be on board of the vision of the project, and he said he wanted to bring a friend into it. Well, his friend is the previous director of the International Space Station for NASA.
Oh, wow.
Astronaut. So here I'm in league with people that are, I cheated my way through math in high school. I don't know what I'm doing, And it just has unfolded. So through them, we've got an engineering plan. This has been in process now for about a year and a half. So it'll be 2 years again.
Fast how fast you turn these around.
Yeah, it's thankfully due to people. You know, there's no solo heroes.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And just have the kind of the bravery to call people up, out of nowhere and pitch a story like this get on board is how these things come to life. So now, so this project, as of right now, has 52 people involved in it.
Wow.
In different professions and regulatory and all sorts. So it's coming to life. So the idea is going to be a helium-filled blimp. And I'm working with these carbon composite engineers in the south of England to build a human hamster wheel. So I'm going to be running a hamster wheel with a direct axle that'll power two carbon propellers on either side for the forward trajectory of it. So I'll be running about 50 meters in the air, and I'll do a marathon through the sky through a fjord called Lysfjord in the west coast of Norway. It's a super beautiful, very dramatic fjord, very Viking looking place. And I'm running the length of it.
That's amazing.
It's exactly 42 kilometers long. So it's perfect. So
that's amazing. So yeah,
that's September 18th.
So, and have you done any trial runs so far in the helium filled?
It's in the process of being built now. Okay. So it's not even a thing yet. So by July, the thing will be built and done and put together. So there's teams working on that now.
That's incredible.
And the fun thing is, and this is the career shift I was talking about, by way of people connecting and helping and actually believing in this story, There's a guy that reached out. He heads up a group called Extreme Media. So they run Extreme TV. So they've backed me on it. So they've actually signed me for a contract for four challenges now to back
amazing
documentary. So, and then even more, they're working with another documentary production group that has an amazing woman named Natalie Humphreys. And Natalie is a British producer, a documentary producer. She produced Blue Planet and Planet Earth 2 and a number of things.
Wow.
And she's actually producing a documentary about the Sky Run. So there's going to be a proper doco coming off the back of this.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And this one is helping a charity called Right to Play. And the goal for this is to raise enough money to help 10,000 kids around the world access education that don't have access to it now.
Wow.
Primarily young girls, because as I'm learning, young girls that don't have access to education usually get ushered into lives they prefer not to have.
Yeah, of course.
But it helps 10,000 kids by running through the sky.
So oh, that's my goodness. Well, we'll make sure that we put all the links in the bio for this podcast as well. Rather than getting you to list them all now and people not having pens to write them, we'll make sure they're all going to the bios and the social media. That is phenomenal. I mean, have you got any ideas for plans after the Sky Run already? Is there something a vision there, or is it very much under wraps at the moment and you just wait and see?
There's loads. There's a lot of small embers already burning. There's some calls that have been made about other things down the track. There's one of my trainers in Australia, a good friend of mine, Craig, in Australia. He told me he's like ex-special forces for Australia. He's a machine. And I remember that's when I was doing the ski race. He was training with me for that, getting me prepped for it. And I brought up the mountain unicycle, which I hadn't even completed the ski race yet. And he had a very hard conversation with me. He said, you are not a unicyclist until you're done being a skier. Right now, skier. So that ingrained in me. So
yeah, I totally understand.
Yeah, so now I'm a runner. The next thing's coming, and the view is it's going to be even crazier. But that's, of course, that's the trajectory. Once your comfort level expands, you know.
Yeah, of course.
So, yeah.
I always finish with a couple of questions, and it's normally, what are your aspirations moving forward? But it's clearly the four-part challenge. That'd be the aspiration. But what would your advice be then to somebody who listens to this or is looking to maybe following a similar route or just life in general, really? What would your advice be?
My advice is, and this is, I've got two things. One, I kind of have a saying in me that I use as a guide point, and that is, if my life story was a book, is it a book that I would love to read?
Yeah.
You know, would that be a page turner for me? And if I wouldn't love to read that book, then I know I need to start rewriting. And so that's a big one. That kind of helps guide my decisions. And sometimes things come up and I'm like, oh, that's crazy. That would be really cool. And then I think, actually, but if I'm reading that book and the character then just says no to that, would I go, why the heck did he just say no? That would have been awesome. So it guides me a bit.
Yeah,
so
that's one.
And the other one is, in terms of our ability to give ourselves permission to do things. Like, I kind of have this view that there's like a smaller Josh inside of me taking notes. He's constantly aware, like making notes of like, okay, he said no to that, so we don't do these things. Yeah. Or actually, he said yes, he tried that. We do that stuff now. And it's just constantly re-steering the ship, because we can start rewriting the story at any time. I'm the kid in school. I was new into that high school as well when I got kicked off the football team. That was super masculine. It was just like, I'm not athletic. I'm not good enough. And then all of a sudden you just give yourself permission to try different things. And it doesn't have to be massive. You know, I'm not trying to inspire people to pogo stick down Mount Everest. You know, it doesn't have to be that. Like, I'm coaching some people right now that are keen to learn how to do a 5K run. Yeah. And it's a massive challenge. And it's a very hard challenge. And it's just the baby steps involved, the incremental changes to get to that point where internally we're like, yeah, because you can hear the language changes from a goal to an identity.
Yeah.
And when you, like, and there's a great book about it called Atomic Habits by an author named James Clear, amazing book. And he gives an example in there of someone that's quitting smoking. If someone's going to say, I want to quit smoking, goal, or I'm no longer a smoker, identity. It's just that mindset shift that we have. And we all have the ability to do that.
Yeah. I remember speaking to a lady once and she was on about smoking. Actually, never. I always thought it was a really good way to look. She said, it came across, it was like, oh, do you smoke? She went, not today. And I was like, all right. She says, I never ever said the word quit because I struggled not to smoke. She says, I haven't smoked for 10 years. She says, but I just haven't smoked today. She says, and if I don't quit, she says, I don't feel guilty if I do have a tab. Uh-huh. And I was like, I quite like the way of looking at it. So she would maybe limit it from 20 a day down to 17. But if she had 18 or 19, it didn't matter because she wasn't trying to quit. She was just limiting what she had that day until she whittled it all the way down. And I thought, actually, it's a nice way to look at things, actually.
Exactly. That's a beautiful example of just that rewriting. That
story. Yeah.
On the incremental changes.
It was a good way to look at things. But Josh, you know, I'm over the moon that you came on the podcast. It was an amazing journey that you've been on, and I really can't wait to watch the sky run and see what comes up after that.
Yeah, that makes two of us.
Thank you so much for coming to the Hobby of a Podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, I can't thank you enough. Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been an honor talking to you, pal. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Hobby of a Lifestyle. Stay safe, stay well, and we'll see you next time.